That's Sarah Groves and her song Going Home. Minnesota's own Sarah Groves, I might add. 10.5 minutes now after the hour on a Wednesday morning. That means none other than Doug Greenwald makes his presence known here. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times out near Washington, D.C., based in Columbia, Maryland. Doug, good morning. It looks a little dark where you are.
Well, it's dark and rainy here. What's it like up in your neck of the woods?
Well, the sun's out, but we're coated with ice. We're a very slickery place to be. Dangerous to even walk around here today.
Really? I've heard there are actually people who live in places like that.
Oh,
now I can say I actually know some of them.
We thrive on it. In fact, we love to fall down. Which is one of the reasons we're here.
You know the old saying, you know, when fate hands you a lemon, squeeze it, and go in the lemonade business.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a great day for you guys because it seems to me this is important for your immigration policy for the state of East Dakota.
Nobody can get in here now.
No. Start running ads, billboard ads in Southern California.
Oh.
Free water and ice.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought of that. But, you know,
good idea.
We already have a lot of Californians up this way, by the way. They retire here. Can you believe that? People come from California to retire here because they want to get out of the milieu there, the chaos and all the strange people. They come here for sanity, is what they do.
Well, they can also buy three houses for the one that they had in California.
That's true, but
they have change.
They haven't paid their plowing bill yet, though.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
Let me know where they spend January through March.
That's good point. Okay, touche.
It's not around here.
No, it's Texas. It's Arizona.
We've got a number of Californians on the road here, and they're on their way, and we kind of grit our teeth and say, okay, you just have to be nice to them for 3 months, and then they're gone again.
Yeah.
Okay. You know. As a Michigan kid who grew up in Michigan, who still loves Michigan, who goes back to Michigan for the lakes most summers, I was just taken back by the beauty of that Brainerd area and north with the lakes.
Mm-hmm. And they're pretty?
Not only pretty, but just the rolling landscape, and then you have some marshes, and then you've got all the lakes, and you got great vistas. And the thing that really surprised me, unlike Michigan, you've got big resorts all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, we may have, I'm familiar with the Traverse City, Elk Rapids, Petoskey area. We may have two or three big resorts like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, just within 10 miles of Brainerd, there's a dozen, 15 of them.
Well, this region, this is the playground for the Twin Cities. And for folks from Indiana and Chicago and California, as we mentioned, it's been a retirement and resort community since the 1890s. And we actually have fewer resorts now than we used to.
Wow.
That has to do with taxes and redevelopment and real estate issues. But resorts and tourists is a big deal up here. So you should come back when there's leaves on the trees.
I would love to come back in the summertime. Because in Michigan, we have what we call our chain of lakes. And I know that's a familiar phrase up there as well. It'll be fun to see Minnesota's chain of lakes.
Mm-hmm. Whitefish chain. No, it's a beautiful place. It's one of the things we enjoy most here. I have always enjoyed just looking at lakes, though. I don't need to fish. I don't need to swim. Although so those are okay things, but mainly just having them around is a treat and a blessing, actually. It's important to us. Doug, you're important to us, too, because you inform us. You teach us continually. And you're about to release a newsletter later this morning. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it's going out in 45 minutes. It's going out at 10 o'clock Eastern time. This one is number 8 in the series called Glimpses into Paul's Roman World. And it's entitled, When Christianity Took Rome, Rome Took Over Christianity. Now, does that little buzzy title get your attention?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. And the first question is, so what did they do to it?
Well, when the Holy Roman Empire started to fade and the historic church began to, I don't say assert itself, but gather momentum and structure and strength, there was a remarkable transition that took place. But at the same time, it was like nothing ever changed. Emperors went away, but popes took their place. Procurators, like Pontius Pilate, the regional governors, they go away. But by way of analogy, cardinals took their place in the structure of the historic church. Mm. Senators in the Roman Empire went away, but bishops took their place. Orators are now gone in the Roman world, but priests have taken their place. The Roman notion of noumena, which is the presence of the gods with us, gets replaced by the notion of angels. The Roman view of lares, which is the domestic guardian deities that you pray to, gets replaced by patron saints. And the basilicas, which are the Roman government record-keeping judicial buildings, become churches. And Roman law goes away, and canon law takes its place. And so while everything changes in the transition from the Holy Roman Empire to the historic church, nothing changes. The structure is completely the same.
Well, and it's kind of like the reverse side of the coin, though, because it was under Caesar Augustus, was it not, that they deified the emperor? So in effect, they created a state religion. So the idea of meshing civil government and faith authority was already established in Rome.
It was, and that's an interesting story all by itself. Julius Caesar was such an effective ruler that out of the eastern part of the empire, namely Greece, came this notion of he must be from the gods. I mean, that kind of thinking has been with the Greeks for a long, long time. It actually gathered some momentum in Rome. There were the Roman Senate actually wanted to make Caesar a god, and he actually resisted it. And after he died, there was a continuing grassroots movement that, I guess you'd say in absentia, or after his death, they determined and ruled and decreed that he really was a god, from the gods. Well, since Augustus is the nephew of Julius Caesar, if Caesar is from the gods, then Augustus must be from the gods. So this is how we get the cult of the imperial governance, if you will, in place in Rome. Interesting, Augustus himself never believed that he was deity, but he loved the notion for political reasons and advanced it at different times, even though he never personally believed it. And then after Augustus, it sort of gathers momentum. And just as a sidebar here to this discussion, the Gospel of Augustus, if we can put it that way, actually paved the way for the Gospel of Jesus. Because the notion, the paradigm is already in place that a man can come from the gods, lowercase g, and be an effective monarch here on earth, okay? And so when Paul comes along and said, let me tell you about the real God, capital G, who came to earth as a human being, it was quite easy for the Roman worldview to pick up that notion and embrace it because of the imperial cult notion had already been contextually put in place for the prior 30 or 40 years. So it's really fascinating how in God's sovereignty, these secular pagan notions actually end up paving the way and can be used by God to prepare the way for his own son and the gospel message.
You know, I was researching some information yesterday on the timing, the calendars involved in Passion Week, and ran across a story about Augustus that kind of struck me, and it kind of typifies the attitude toward those emperors, especially Julius Caesar and Augustus. You know, they're the only two emperors that have months named for them. And they used to just number the months. That would be the Latin word for the number of the month. It was month number 5 or month number 6 until Julius Caesar came along. Now, I'm thinking this, you would never see this today, but the Roman Senate, after Julius Caesar's death, named the month of July, comes from Julius, and it had 31 days in it. Later comes Caesar Augustus, and his cronies, his Senate, decided he should be co-equal with Julius Caesar. So they named the month that we know as August after Caesar Augustus. But that wasn't good enough, because August then only had 30 days. In the old calendar, they would alternate 30 days, 31 days, 30 days, 31 days. They said that, no, Augustus should not be inferior to Caesar. His month must have 31 days, too. It's one of the reasons February was short. They took a day from February, put it at the end of August, and called it the month of August in honor of Caesar Augustus. So that notion of the deity of the emperor is kind of reflected in that. I mean, can you think of a president now where they would actually rename a month or a day?
No, but we certainly rename days.
We do?
Martin Luther King Day, absolutely.
Holidays, certainly. Yeah, certain holidays. But
well, there is no end to the inspirational discoveries here on the Broken Road Radio.
Well, I hope not. I hope not.
Doug, you've watched House of Cards, right?
Actually, no.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, well, I won't explain the entire plot. It's worth watching, but in one of the asides, Kevin Spacey, playing the major character, said he wouldn't give two hoots for a guy who insists on more money. He said more power is what he's after. And then in another program I watched yesterday, he says, yeah, this guy is rich, but Lyndon Johnson didn't get his office building, but he did get a presidential library. Power is the thing that lasts. You'll spend money by next weekend, but the stuff, the trappings, the naming stuff after you lasts forever.
Well, the veneration, does. And we make, in a sense, we make gods of a lot of historic figures and pretty nearly worship them.
Well, David, the Ford Motor Company has already sort of lionized you.
No. Mm-hmm. With the punt mobile?
Well, no, the punt pass and kick competition.
Okay. I thought maybe you were going to say that we're going to rename the Chevy Volt.
Anyway, back to the Roman world.
Yeah.
Freeze that thought about the transition of the hierarchy of the Holy Roman Empire becomes the hierarchy of the historic church. Okay. Now I want to take you back to 326 AD, or as they say these days, BCE, I guess CE. Helena comes to the Holy Land. She's already 76 years old. I just found that out a few days ago. Hmm. I mean, this is in a time frame when the average person lives to be 42. And she is sort of on a mission. She wants to commemorate phrases of the Apostles' Creed so that they can be memorialized, so to speak. And she gets to Bethlehem. And she decides that an edifice needs to be built here, which turns out to be the Church of the Nativity, to remember that phrase, born of a virgin. Then she goes to Jerusalem, and there's that phrase in the Creed, rose from the dead, he is risen. And she authorizes the building of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And over the next 100 years, this tradition continues, and there are edifices / cathedrals popping up all over the Holy Roman Empire. Now, prior to 332, or let's see, the Church of the Nativity got done in 338, okay? Prior to 338, the body of Christ, the followers of Jesus, looked at each other and said, we are the church, okay? 100 years later, after all these edifices start populating up around the empire, the followers of Jesus recharacterize themselves and say, we go to church. And something huge happened in their view of what Peter calls the royal priesthood. Okay. From we are the church to now we go to church. A living organic reality now gets shifted to be a physical structure. So that's thought number one. That's when the notion of a royal priesthood begins to get blurry or foggy. Then we end up in this transition between the Holy Roman Empire and the historic church, where the hierarchy of the Holy Roman Empire just gets moved over lock, stock, and barrel, just with new occupants in each of the levels. And we have a very hierarchical church. The church before the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem had a very simple hierarchy, elders and deacons, and they were all contained in the same house church, okay? After the historic church parallels the structure of the Holy Roman Empire, the vast majority of the hierarchy of the church is outside the local congregation. It's now run by the clerics, which, interestingly, I was researching a couple days ago. The root word for cleric is the same as the root word for clerk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we have been living with the consequences of that transition ever since. Because once the structure of the Holy Roman Empire got paralleled right across into the historic church, some changes took place. Now we have the clergy who are seen as the spiritual ones, the trained ones, and they're providing guidance and oversight to the congregation who are the untrained ones and the secular ones and who need oversight. And suddenly ministry became cast as something that the clerics do, and the people in the pew simply sit and watch. And so a whole passivity notion gets introduced here into the body of Christ as we have this segmentation between clerics and congregants, and further, I want to almost say destroys, but further obfuscates the royal priesthood, the vitality, the dynamic of the first century, second century church. And quite honestly, we've been living with the consequences of that ever since. And it struck me the other day that while we had the Reformation, which we're familiar with, it was primarily looking at theological issues. And through the rearview mirror, you know, they've been encapsulated as the solas, sola scriptura, only scripture interprets scripture, sola fide, only faith, sola gratia, only grace, sola Christus, only Christ, and sola da gloria. Lost in that was the priesthood of all believers. Now, that is Luther's term, and he uses it in the Reformation context. It actually hangs on for a while, but it never really gained enough traction, and it starts to fade away from the scene, and now it's completely absent from our contemporary church scene. We're steeped in clericalism, and I wonder if the Reformation that still remains is a rediscovery and a recommitment to the priesthood of all believers, just like the early church had before all the hierarchy began to be put in place. Mm. That's what this particular newsletter is about.
Well, that's a tremendous topic, and I've done some reading on that recently too, and a lot of it goes back to Constantine, and you mentioned those basilicas. Wasn't it under his reign that he actually provided church buildings? We didn't have church buildings up until that time, and of course Helena, but even starting under Constantine's reign, he took those basilicas and gave them to the church as worship sites in order to build Christianity, the reputation of it. And probably
well, and
at
that
the
was in addition to these edifices that were springing up around too, that we might put in the cathedral category. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there was a lot of commingling of the church and state, and that's why it was so easy for this transference of structure to take place, and why the historic church populated all of its hierarchical levels in the same way that the Holy Roman Empire did.
And it's amazing the effect that a building can have on a congregation. I mean, now we sit shoulder to shoulder, straight rows, looking forward at a raised stage in most churches, and there's a praise band up there, and there's a pulpit, and there is a central figure of a pastor who looks down on all these people and preaches. I think that stems directly from those old basilicas, which they were used for speeches, weren't they, by politicians, by people who wielded power. And they were designed to elevate the image of that speaker over the audience, were they not?
In part, they were. A lot of the speaking was actually done in the forum, and there are actually speaking sites, you know, mm-hmm. around forums where that kind of thing could take place for larger crowds. In the forum, there was something called the Pompa, which is the reviewing stand for big events, and from which we get our notion of pomp and circumstance. But yeah, there's a lot of commingling in that way, and that's the whole point. The structure of the church got commingled with the structure of the Holy Roman Empire. I'm not sure that was a good thing.
No, I'm not either. In fact, I think I agree for the lack of spontaneity in church services now. When the worshipers were worshipers, they were participants and kind of governed the service in mass. You know, songs would come spontaneously out of the group of worshipers, and that doesn't happen anymore. Now we look at screens, and we obey commands from the stage.
There's a it's the use of the word stage. You know, and I've been thinking about something that for years and years and years, people have traced the evolution or the beginnings of theater refer to the early church or the early cathedrals or the early and even the structure of the opening looks a lot like the structure of your average stage, the thrust stage, and you know, with wings on either side. I guess I'm hearing that we're to sit in pews looking forward as if in a performance. And there seems to be a connection there as well. Were there other things going on in the churches, in the old cathedrals, besides church services?
It fascinated me. On our Paul's Roman World study program, as well as our Life and Land of Jesus program, when we get into these Roman situations, and there's a reasonably well theater that's still in place, I could close my eyes and I could envision the same layout and structure for some of these big box churches of 3,000 to 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the orientation of the seats, the dais, the stage, it's like it hasn't changed in 2,000 years. So there is a lot of parallelisms between the theater of the Greco-Roman world and some of our larger church structures today, particularly the more modern ones.
Mm. There's another book out there, too, that deals with this in great depth. It's called Pagan Christianity. And it was written several years ago, and I think it was 2007, thereabout. But basically affirms everything you've told us, Doug, and it bemoans the fact that we've changed. So we've gotten away from house churches, we've gotten away from that spontaneity, and from the priesthood of all believers, because now we've become an audience, and we look at other activities of our churches to really satisfy us. It's the small groups, it's the mission trips, it's the other kind of involvement. But the worship services have changed so drastically since the original church, where I understand they used to meet in cemeteries. They would actually meet over the graves of the martyrs, for example. They had no buildings back then.
There may be some historical record of that, mm-hmm. but the vast majority of Paul's house churches met in atriums of mm-hmm. Roman villas.
Well, this was even, that all goes together to bring us to where we are today, and I'm not sure we're in the best place.
Well, just, freeze this thought for a moment. The first one-third of all Roman villas are considered to be public space, and that's where the atrium, the front atrium, is to be found. Mm. And so, I mean, that's an interesting concept all by itself, that one-third of your house is available to the public at any moment in time. But that's where many of the early house churches met. And 20 or 30 people coming together after dark. I mean, you couldn't do it during the day because the slaves were on duty. You had to wait till dark when they were off duty. But 20 or 30 people come together. A, they're all known. B, by and large, they're all cared for in that community. And C, they're all engaged in ministry in one form or another, either to each other or to the world or to the house that they are a slave into. So this notion of each person known, each person cared for, and each person engaged in ministry is sort of the dynamic of the priesthood of all believers. And contrast that now with a big box Sunday morning worship where you're much more passive. You don't know the person who's sitting next to you. You enter your seat and walk out without knowing anyone that you saw, maybe not even engaging them. You're there to be, in our narcissistic culture, you're there for what's in it for me, not how can I serve and how can I give? I mean, just a lot of dynamics have been tipped upside down in this transition from the early house churches through the building of edifices and then the establishment of the hierarchy of the historic church. And it strikes me that at least in our notions of the priesthood of all believers, it's the Reformation that still awaits us.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's another aspect that strikes me as significant here, and that has to do with finances. I mean, once a church is saddled with a building, with real estate, with maybe with taxes, depending on the legislative standing of the church, snow plowing, maintenance, all of a sudden the people are tithing or giving money or contributing to the maintenance of a building as opposed to helping other people. I mean, it takes a huge chunk of Christian resources, doesn't it?
Well, not only that, but one of the books I've been fascinated with in the last year is John Dickerson's book, The Great Evangelical Recession, Six Factors That Will Crash the American Church and How to Prepare for It. Big box churches, by and large, their giving is going down year after year, and by significant chunks, like 10 and 15% per year.
Wow.
So this is putting enormous pressure on churches, and his prediction is that in 20 years, the number of paid pastors is going to be conspicuous by its absence. There are going to be very few that we're going to have to get back to the reality of the house, the tent-making ministry pastor. You know, the pastor who has a job during the day and mm-hmm. is pastoring at night and on the weekends. And that's actually going to actually sound and look much more like the early house churches where there were no paid staff. Where everyone had full-time things to do, and yet they saw themselves as being engaged in full-time ministry at the same time. So some of the crunches and some of the pressures that are coming may actually be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that's an honest-to-goodness trend, because personally I would love to find a house church, a group of 10, 20, 30, 40 people maybe meeting in a home. And free of all those other encumbrances, and being able to meet in a circle and hug each other and see each other and sing together and worship together as one. I think we're just not there now. And hopefully the trend you suggested will happen. I'd love to see that.
Doug, I know of one.
You do?
There is one in Brainerd.
Is it a house church?
Yeah, it's a house church. And the Gary West, the friend of ours that moved to
lives in the Philippines now. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a member of that church, and mm-hmm. I met the minister. The guy rides a motorcycle and works at one of the local factories, and he said, "You know, this minister business is just a nights and weekends thing."
Mm-hmm.
So I know of one. I don't know that that's a trend or not, or just that I happen to stumble into him.
By the way, I think
there's somebody out there.
I think we're going to talk to Gary again really soon here on the air and catch up with him and his ministry now in the Philippines. Doug, before you go, we're running out of time. We don't really have time to get into this, but I wonder if you can kind of set it up for us. And next week, perhaps, we can tackle this one. Jesus, his disciples, sailing across Galilee to Decapolis for a very important reason. And you call it the instance of the healing of the demoniac. Set that up for us so we can tackle that in earnest next week.
Yeah, let me do that. And let me put a PS on our body life discussion here.
Mm-hmm.
In Luke 4, when Jesus goes back to Nazareth and he's asked to read from the Isaiah scroll on a Shabbat morning, and he does. And then he does a cut and paste from Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. I call it his rescue manifesto. And among other things, he says he has come to set the prisoners free, those who are oppressed. And then he begins to actually do precisely that. And I think the supreme example of his rescue manifesto in Luke 4 is in Luke 8, when he puts the disciples in the boat at the end of a day and says, get in a boat now. We're going to the other side, which is a code word for the Decapolis, the Greco-Roman world that Jews are forbidden to go to.
Mm.
And so it sets up an immediate shock therapy situation with his disciples. And they get in the boat, and as very unhappy campers, they start sailing to the other side, and they get caught in a violent storm. And that's where we'll pick that story up next week. But I like to call this an incredible, loving rescue. And for me, it's the supreme rescue story of the Gospels, and as Jesus lives out that he has come to set the prisoners free, in this case, the prisoners of demon possession.
Well, we'll look forward to that next Wednesday then. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug?
Just a final observation on House Church, okay? Mm-hmm. And some of these other topics that we've been discussing here. I've taught spiritual gift workshops maybe almost 100 times in the 80s. I was absolutely enthralled with this notion of the priesthood of all believers. And some of the things that I've learned and picked up along the way are like this. In any church of 300 or 400 people, okay, there are one or two people in the pews who can do a better job of bringing a Sunday morning sermon than the pastor himself. There are probably 8 or 10 people with the gift of pastoring in the pew who can do a better job of pastoring people than the pastor himself. There are probably at least 3 to 4 people in the pews who have the spiritual gift of leadership in a more abundant quality and in a more refined manner than the pastor himself. Now, why in the world are we letting pastors do all these things when it's not necessarily where they're gifted, and when we have people in the pew who are more gifted than they are to do these things? It seems to me we have to completely shift our paradigm of what it means to be a pastor slash minister, not to be the chief executive officer of a church, but to be the facilitating shepherd of the flock that gets everybody in motion using their spiritual gifts that they've been given. And your job is not to drive the bus, but to be at the front door of the bus, making sure everyone gets on and in their right seats. So commingled with this whole notion of rediscovering the priesthood of all believers, I think we have to rediscover and redefine our notions, our paradigm for what it means to be a pastor slash minister in an ordained sense.
Excellent point. Doug, thank you. The website, preservingbibletimes.org, wonderful resource for your church or for you personally, for your small groups, preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to them from us at brokenroadradio.com. Doug, thanks so much. Shalom. We'll see you next week.
Shalom, guys. Take care. Doug.